Chapter 11. Dig Two Graves.
I have this dream where I cut out my tongue so I can make promises that can never be done.
Against the blackness of space, broken pieces of warships continued to drift along their last vectors, propelled outwards from their points of destruction. Search and rescue ships moved amongst them, picking up escape pods that had survived the deaths of their ships. Most were Naboo, but a few were marked with the emblem of the Trade Federation, promising Nemoidian officers who had probably been among the few living beings aboard their droid-crewed warships. They would receive life, but only at the cost of their liberty for the remainder of the war. Beyond the two debris fields that marked the places where the space battles had taken place, battlefields that covered hundreds of thousands of kilometers as measured on the ground, light minutes as measured in space, lingered the ships of the Naboo home fleet. Massive battle stars stood by to receive the recovered escape pods, accompanied by cruisers and destroyers that served as their escort ships. Much further out in the system, battle cruisers and their escorts traced paths back and forth across seemingly empty space, alert to any treachery. Previous experience had shown that even after their departure, the Trade Federation war fleets had a tendency to leave nasty surprises behind for unwary ships to run into. The benefit of fighting with droids rather than organic beings was that they didn't require the luxury of life support. "I'm picking up a Naboo distress signal up ahead, but I don't have any life signs on my boards," said Lieutenant Orica Rohe, the pilot of the search and rescue ship Cuirass, one of several attached to the Battlestar Indefatigable. "Are you getting any clearer readings?" Lieutenant Junior Grade Kai Mori, her navigator, studied his sensor board and finally offered doubtfully, "Could be an astromech or an N1 pilot. Some of the older birds still have signaling problems. We're a little far out from the battlefield, but a couple of the other fighters drifted pretty far, too." Orica shrugged, angling Cuirass in the direction of the signal. At almost 2 days after the battle had begun, most of the Naboo escape pods had already been recovered, but the fleet wouldn't rest until they were certain that no one had been left behind to a slow, lingering death as the life support systems in the pods ran out. In the Naboo home system, normally heavily trafficked by both civilian and military vessels, that was vanishingly unlikely. But no one from Fleet would protest the extra effort, even if the recovery went on for weeks. After all, someday it might be them out there. Cuirass slid among the debris left from destroyed Federation and Naboo ships. Later, after they were certain that they had recovered all survivors and any equipment that might hold data, the wreckage would be blown to dust. As it was, it posed a navigation hazard even in the vastness of a single star system. But for now, it remained intact. Well, as intact as wreckage could be, anyway. The search and rescue ship was accompanied by a trio of N1 starfighters as escorts, since battle droids were capable of acting in the vacuum of space and would happily go after any Naboo starships that crossed their paths. Not far away, a group of buzz droids was cannibalizing the remains of a Trade Federation destroyer, brainlessly going after the few functioning systems that remained on the defunct ship. Orica tapped her comlink and said, "Take care of those for me, will ya?"
"Razor 2, aye."
"Razor 3, aye."
Two of the N1s slid away from the Cuirass. Laser fire flicked out an instant later, turning the buzz droids into so much scrap metal as the N1s flipped around and returned to their positions. Orica kept an eye on her boards as Cuirass nosed past the wreckage into a relatively clear area behind the battlefield.
"I'm not seeing much wreckage out here," Kai said from behind Orica, studying his own boards. "Still no life signs."
"Got it! Looks like whatever it was registered our approach and strengthened its signal."
One of our droids? She asked. The signal, which had before been flickering intermittently, was now glowing strongly on her nav boards.
Code matches. Do you have a visual?
Not yet. The Mark I eyeball didn't do much good in space, though search and rescue ships like Quiras, which also served as shuttles and troop transports outside of combat zones, were fitted out with viewports, unlike the bigger warships in the Naboo fleet. Right now, all Oroka could see was aimlessly floating debris, along with a handful of battle droids still trying weakly to claw themselves to something they could hold onto.
Vacuum made them look like they were swimming in space.
Without repulsors or anything to push off, they were unable to move. Far away in the distance, a set of blinking lights indicated one of the patrol flotillas. While to Quiras's port side, repairs had already begun on one of the orbital battle stations aboard the Planet Widow. It was another 15 minutes before Quiras closed on the source of the distress signal. They were well beyond the spreading outer edge of the battlefield now, where Oroka sensors told her the Republic warships had appeared during the battle.
"Look out for mines," she warned Kai, who made a noise of assent. "Every sensor I have is scanning for threats," he told her. "Crew is on alert. We're getting a low power spike."
"How low?" Oroka squinted through the viewport, seeing the source almost immediately. What she had taken for another piece of debris turned out to be an astromech droid activating its repulsors, which, at this distance, were a faint blue flare against the black beyond.
"Astromech," she told Kai, who nodded.
"I'm not picking up any wreckage from its bird," he said doubtfully.
"There isn't any," Oroka said. "I'm not seeing anything out here except our droid."
She touched her comlink to connect her to Quiras's small crew.
"Yara, Gwenny, our target's an astromech droid. Looks like an R2 unit. I'm going to bring us around and back up to him. He seems mobile, but get the tractor beam ready just in case he can't come inside on his own. Spacewalk shouldn't be necessary on this one."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Still no threats?" Oroka asked Kai, as Quiras reversed and began to close the distance between them and the astromech.
"Still no threats," Kai confirmed. "If our new friend here is wormed, then we're not going to find out until the security scans people back on Indy get a look at him. No explosives, nothing biological or chemical."
Oroka brought Quiras to a dead stop as a collision warning flashed across her boards.
"Rear hatch opening,"
Chief Petty Officer Yara's voice reported over the internal comm system.
"Package secure. Hatch closed. Okay, we're clear."
"Roger that. Find out what he was doing so far from the battlefield, Chief."
Oroka angled Quiras back toward the battlefield to receive their sweep. But a few minutes later, her comm link buzzed again.
"LT, we've got a problem."
Oroka and Kai both froze. Carefully, Kai said.
"Chemical or biological, Chief?"
"Not that kind of problem, sir. The astromech says that he was jettisoned by the Republic warships with a message for Queen Amidala."
"What?"
Oroka said blankly.
"Say again?"
"The astromech, its number is R2-D2.
Oroka and Kai both swore.
"I know,"
Yara said grimly.
"Almost everyone in the Naboo military knew of that droid."
"He says he was jettisoned by the Republic warships, and he has an urgent message for the Queen from Captain Kenobi."
The Grand Army of the Republic was by both nature and design insular. Rex could count on one hand the number of times he'd interacted with non-Gar military personnel in anything other than a hostile capacity. Going by the number of clones he had seen so far in Theed, he had expected the Royal Naboo security forces to be more of the same, which meant that it had taken him longer than he liked to admit to realize that the RNSF wasn't divided into Naboo regulars and clone troopers. Aside from her handmaidens,
Queen Amidala's security detail was mostly made up of regulars. Only a quarter were clones. No one had even looked twice at him, which Rex would have considered an inexcusable breach of security if he hadn't been taken aside by one of the other clones to be fitted out in an RNSF uniform, apparently at the orders of one of the Queen's interchangeable handmaidens. Drift hadn't asked for his identification number, rank, or unit, just his nickname, and didn't seem surprised that Rex had apparently attached himself to one of Queen Amidala's handmaidens. Rex didn't find out why until the next morning. He had tagged along with a mixed group of clones and regulars when they had all gone off duty at the end of the Queen's official day, expecting them to separate once they reached the barracks. But instead, they had all stuck together the way any Gar squad would. By then, they had all been awake for almost 24 hours, Rex nearly twice that, and he had been too tired to do anything except eat the food in front of him and bed down in a spare bunk. Drift's 8-man squad was evenly split between clone troopers and regulars, minus the guy whose bed Rex had slept in, apparently on leave in the Southern Isles visiting his family when the attack had occurred. Two of the remaining regulars were women, while the third was a Theed native, who had asked for and received permission to go home to his parents' place after the bombardment. That left the four clones, Drift, Foxtrot, Hod, and Glitz, who didn't have their ident numbers anywhere that Rex could see. Rex had worked with non-clones since the war had begun, but with rare exception, they had all been Jedi. And Jedi were a different breed altogether than either clones or regulars, which in the Gar usually meant specialty operators or starship crews. Regulars never fraternized with clones. Most Jedi didn't fraternize with anybody but other Jedi. He'd spoken to enough troopers from units other than the 501st and 212th to know that what he thought of as his trio was unusual because they treated clones as people. Apparently, none of that mattered in the RNSF. Rex had been too exhausted to notice last night, but he definitely noticed the next morning. Walking into the palace mess and finding clones and regular personnel interacting, as equals, as comrades, as friends, was enough of a shock that Rex froze just inside the door, staring in surprise before Foxtrot elbowed him to get him out of the way. He followed Foxtrot to the nearest queue, collecting a tray and a plate of food he didn't recognize, but which looked and smelled more appetizing than the Gar rations he was used to. "You've been out in the cold a while?" Foxtrot asked, after they'd settled down at a table, along with the rest of the group they had come in with. "Something like that," Rex said, trying to decide if using a fork instead of chopsticks would mark him as an outsider. Then he saw Hod sawing at what turned out to be a meat-filled steamed bun of some sort with knife and fork, which made up his mind. "Pizza. Classified." Foxtrot nodded as if that was the answer he had been expecting, using his own chopsticks effortlessly as he picked up some noodles. Rex ate hungrily. Definitely better than anything the guard ever provided, though since that was food capsules and ration bars, it wasn't exactly a high bar to pass. And tried to work out a way to ask about the mixed company. Unsurprisingly, the topic of conversation at the round table was the Federation bombardment. All the regulars had lived through the occupation a decade earlier, and the clones had picked up on their comrades' intense hatred for the Republic, the Trade Federation, and the other commerce guilds. Reprisal was the word on everyone's lips. Blood for blood. It hadn't been Rex's people out there dying, but he understood the sentiment. What surprised him was that the clones were just as vicious as the regulars, even though Naboo wasn't their homeworld. By dint of a few delicate, and delicately timed, questions, Rex eventually worked out that only two of the clones he was sitting with had come from the same batch back on Kamino, and that none of them were permanently assigned to the palace guard. Instead, Amidala and Kenobi rotated the clones and the regulars through the planet-side detail with the various branches of the RNSF and off-world detail with the Naboo units attached to the Confederate military. Both ground forces and space navy depending. It led to less specialization, but more personal loyalty, especially on the part of the clones. Rex could admire that. Few of the clones in the Gar had really understood what they were fighting for, just thought they were fighting, while the Confederate clones he'd met considered themselves as much Naboo as the regulars. Which meant, he realized after several minutes' thought, the topic of conversation had moved on to some kind of sporting event he had never heard of before, that every clone in the Confederate military was owned by Naboo, not by the Confederacy itself. Rex had a rough conception of how much individual clones were worth, and even if Naboo had only a fraction of the clones that the Gar had, that must have cost a fortune. He didn't know much about galactic politics, but while he knew that Naboo was a resource-rich planet, he had never heard of it being called a particularly wealthy one. They had to be so deep in hock to the banking clan that it would take them a century or more to pay off. It took him a couple of minutes to realize that one of the regulars, a young woman who seemed barely out of her teens, was trying, not terribly subtly, to ask him if he was assigned to something that she referred to obliquely as the unit. Rex had been around enough clone commandos to have a pretty good idea of what she was actually asking him. I couldn't say a specialist, he told her, which she, unsurprisingly, took as a yes. She grinned in delight, sitting back in her seat, so pleased by his answer that Rex almost felt bad for lying, even though he hadn't technically done anything of the sort. It was an answer that satisfied all the other questions that no one else had asked, though. And Rex, listening carefully to what was and wasn't said, came to the conclusion that Queen Amidala's Captain Kenobi really did have a specialized unit, some of whose members dated all the way back to the occupation. Rex had spent the past 3 years watching the Jedi work and knew the difference between what they were capable of, what they were trained for, and what they were willing to do. If Captain Kenobi and his unit did even a quarter of that, then he was honored to be considered a member of their ranks, even if it wasn't strictly true. His CO was General Obi-Wan Kenobi of the Grand Army of the Republic, not Captain Obi-Wan Kenobi of the Royal Naboo Security Forces. They were finishing up as one of the night shifts came in. Drift, the squad leader, was consulting his data pad and drinking the last of his calf. "We on or off today, Top?" Glitz asked. "Everyone's gonna be on for a while, looks like," Drift said. "Duffer says he's gonna be stuck in the aisles until the civilian transports start running again." There were grins and groans all around. "Tef chose a heck of a time to take a vacation," said Kylan, one of the women. "Lucky bastard. Harik still out too?" "On his way in. We're on the palace today. Alpha has the queen." He glanced up at Rex. "I've got to find my principal," Rex said. He wasn't sure who to ask, to find out where the generals and Senator Amidala had spent the night, and he didn't know the palace well enough to guess. But someone had to know, and he'd find out sooner or later. "Thanks for the hospitality stuff, Sergeant." Drift nodded. "You or your people need anything. You know where to find us." "Will do, Steph." It had been a while since Rex had been treated as anything less than a field grade officer. His official rank in the Gar was captain, but he was used to functioning as second in command of an entire battalion, and ranks in the Gar were fast and loose things anyway. usually dependent on the preferences of whatever Jedi general was in charge. It was a hell of a way to run an army, but it had always worked for the Gar. The RNSF was clearly much more strictly regimented. Rex saw a handful of clone officers, but most of the clones on the base seemed to be enlisted men, or NCOs, with Naboo regulars making up the majority of the officer corps. Rex's borrowed utes didn't have any rank insignia on them, which got him a few odd looks, but no one took him to task for the lack. Drift had treated him like another NCO. Rex suspected that if he had realized that Rex was a senior officer, he would have been passed off to someone else entirely, and it had been clones that Rex wanted to talk to. It turned out that being a clone trooper in an RNSF utility uniform let Rex wander around more or less freely, at least in the low-security areas of the RNSF base. Just like the Gar, if you looked and acted like you belonged, then everyone would assume you did. Being a clone helped, since there was only one person in the galaxy who could fake that, and Jango Fett was years dead. Or maybe he wasn't here. The realization actually stopped Rex dead in his paces, though he stepped to the side so that he didn't block the colonnaded walkway he was exploring. He had never studied under Jango Fett when he was a cadet, but he knew other clones who had, and the memory of the training holos they showed on Kamino was fresh in his mind. There was a reason that Jango Fett had been chosen as the template for the most terrible army the galaxy had ever seen. If the Battle of Geonosis had never taken place in this universe, and as far as Rex could tell, it hadn't, then was it possible that Jango Fett was still alive? He had been a topic of gossip on Kamino up until the point when he had been declared an enemy of the state. Rex knew that he had been filling bounties even after the clone army had been deployed for the first time. If he was still alive, and still working as Count Dooku's private attack dog, then he could walk right into the palace at Theed the same way Rex had done. Only Rex had clone DNA markers, which Fett didn't. If RNSF security was even halfway decent, they would check for the markers before letting strange clones in. But Fett might be dead anyway, making the matter irrelevant. Frowning to himself, Rex started walking again. Whether or not Jango Fett still lived was a matter of more concern to the Jedi than it was to him personally. So he set it aside to ask the generals about later. The Theed City RNSF base bordered the Royal Palace to the east and included the Royal Guard Barracks, an active-duty RNSF battalion, and the Theed City RNSF station. Though not Planetary Defense Quarters, which was apparently located somewhere else in the city so as not to be centralized within the palace. Since it had been leveled in the Trade Federation bombardment, the rumors Rex had heard said that it had been one of the first buildings hit, and one of the handful that had definitely been targeted. That had probably been a wise decision on the part of whoever had built it. The base itself had sustained relatively minor damage in the bombardment, though relatively was the key word, rather than minor. At least one of the Starfighter Corps barracks had been destroyed, and the plasma refinery, which supplied power for the palace and fuel for the starfighters, had been damaged. The main refinery had been shut down for repairs, though a secondary facility was still operating. Unlike the austere facilities of the Gar, which were purely functional, nothing more and nothing less, the RNSF base had clearly been designed for the aesthetics of the Naboo. To Rex's eyes, the clean lines and decorative stonework and greenery seemed completely unnecessary. But he could tell that the space had been purpose-built within the past decade or so as a military base, rather than having been repurposed from something else. From what he knew of the planet, the Naboo must have ripped down whatever had been here before the occupation and built the base when it became clear that they were going to need standing military. Coruscant and the rest of the Republic had been militarized within 3 years. Naboo had done the same, if not more, in 13 years. Thoughtfully, Rex wandered purposefully around the base, working out where he was and wasn't allowed to go without needing further clearance. In the wake of the bombardment, the base was full of military and emergency personnel, squads of soldiers passing in and out on their way to the city or the other affected areas around Theed. After Rex had satisfied his curiosity, he attached himself to one of these groups, carefully timing his addition so that he joined one that was put together of soldiers assigned elsewhere that had been in Theed during the bombardment. He'd seen plenty of bombarded cities before. He wanted to see how the Naboo dealt with the aftermath. Now that told you about a people. Ahsoka Tano flattened her hand against the security panel, waiting for it to read her palm print and turn green. Once it had, she hit the controls to open the hatch, listening to the locks click open inside. Beyond that was a short hallway, then another hatch with a second security scan. Ahsoka glanced around as she waited for the palm scan to complete, taking in the security cams in the corners and the ray shield generators in the ceiling. If she hadn't known to look for it, she might have missed the vents in the walls, which would disperse a knockout agent if triggered from Paladin's bridge. It was the most secure cell on Paladin. Probably the most secure cell in the Republic fleet. Ahsoka knew every trick and trap in it, and she still had no idea how anyone could get past it. The security panel turned green. This door had to be opened manually, one of the few such Ahsoka had seen in the civilized Republic, and swung outwards toward her rather than receding into the wall. Ahsoka stepped inside and immediately pulled the hatch shut behind her. Master Tiplar had been doing stretches on a meditation mat. She didn't stop for Ahsoka, but finished her set before standing up. "Hello, Ahsoka," she said. "Did anything happen during the holoconference?" "Not that anyone told me," Ahsoka said. "We went back into hyperspace a couple of hours ago." "I felt it," Tiplar said. She rolled up her meditation mat and tucked it under her arm, stepping past Ahsoka to lay her hand on the security panel. As soon as it blinked green, she pushed the door open and went out into the hallway. Ahsoka unrolled her own meditation mat and settled down in a lotus position. She sat quiet for a few minutes, trying to calm her disordered mind, then stood up again and did a few stretches of her own. Somehow, she couldn't shake the disquiet caused by the humming of the ray shield a few meters away, not when she could still remember the conflict in the Force during the holoconference. She hadn't sat in on it, not even behind a security screen that would have allowed her to watch but not participate. But raised tempers among 4 council-level masters and a knight wasn't something she could miss. She didn't know what had caused the argument, but she had a pretty good idea. He was right on the other side of the ray shield, after all. Frustrated, Ahsoka kicked her meditation mat aside and leaned back against the counter behind her, crossing her arms over her chest. "They say you're a traitor." Obi-Wan Kenobi had been doing pull-ups on the bar in the corner of the cell, but at this, he dropped lightly to the ground and turned towards the ray shield, picking up one of his discarded tunics to wipe sweat from his face. Ahsoka studied him. She had seen him on the holonews, of course, everyone had, but she had expected him to be different in person. Darker. More evil. Like one of the dark Jedi from her history holos. Cunning and vicious and cruel. Instead, he just seemed like another Jedi Knight, one of the thousands that passed through the temple between missions. She thought that was unfair. He should at least have felt like something other than a Jedi in the Force. The argument during the holoconference had caused a greater disturbance in the Force than his presence did, which was just wrong. Kenobi considered her for a moment, then said,
"That depends on your point of view."
"You sound like my master," Ahsoka said.
"I always liked Master Plo,"
Kenobi said, pulling his shirt on.
"He was one of my master's best friends."
"I know," Ahsoka said. "He told me that once. He said you would have made a good knight, and that you were tapped to sit on the council someday even when you were still a Padawan."
Kenobi snorted. "I doubt that," he said. "Master Plo flatters me."
Ahsoka had thought so too at the time. Having now met Obi-Wan Kenobi, she wasn't so sure anymore. "You're still a traitor." He shrugged.
"Like I said, that depends on your point of view. If it helps, I don't consider myself a traitor."
"Traitors never do," Ahsoka pointed out.
"Having probably met more traitors than you, young Padawan, I'd have to agree," Kenobi said.
He sat down on the end of his cot, folding his legs tailor-style and settling his hands in his lap.
"Friends of yours?" Ahsoka said dryly. "No, the people I was arresting for conspiring against my queen," Kenobi replied. His voice was calm. "And before you get the idea that they were some kind of heroes, they were attempting to overthrow the lawfully elected government. Even the Republic tends to frown on that. Officially, anyway. I know the Senate was supporting a few of them unofficially."
"I don't believe you!"
"I know," Kenobi told her, almost kindly. "I was a Jedi once, remember? I used to believe the best of the Senate, too."
Ahsoka scowled at him. "Everyone knows that some members of the Senate are corrupt," she said, remembering a conversation she had had with Master Plo. "But that doesn't mean the entire institution is flawed. The Chancellor doesn't appear to be corrupt." His mouth quirked.
"Dooku is a politician. I have observed that he is very clever at following the passions of the Senate."
"You follow the Galactic Senate?" Ahsoka said, staring in disbelief.
"Know your enemy," Kenobi said. He smiled sheepishly. "I'd rather not, believe me, but it is something of a necessity in my line of work."
Ahsoka shook her head. "Curiously," Kenobi added,
"I'm surprised you're speaking to me. Aside from Quinn and Master Windu, most of the Jedi come in here and pretend I don't exist. I was beginning to think there was a moratorium on acknowledging my presence. It does seem like something Master Windu would do."
Ahsoka hesitated, then admitted,
"I was curious about you. Everyone says that you betrayed the Jedi."
Kenobi's mouth twisted, but his voice was even as he said,
"No, I resigned from the Order. Supreme Chancellor Dooku did the same, but no one in the Order calls him a traitor."
He was actually wrong about that, but Ahsoka wasn't about to tell him so. It wasn't like it was a popular opinion in the Order anyway. Even Jedi weren't supposed to openly criticize the Supreme Chancellor of the Republic. Especially Jedi. Kenobi considered her thoughtfully, massaging his shoulder where his subcutaneous tracker had been taken out after he'd been transferred from Sakak to Paladin. Eventually, he said,
"What else do they say about me, young Padawan?"
Ahsoka shifted uncomfortably from foot to foot. Kenobi's expression was calm, vaguely curious. There was an edge in the Force that Ahsoka didn't like, but she suspected it had more to do with her nerves than his.
Finally, she said reluctantly, that you're a dark Jedi.
He snorted.
Well, that's not exactly a surprise.
Off her expression, he added, I'd come to that conclusion myself.
Feeling daring, Ahsoka asked.
Are you?
Kenobi didn't answer immediately, apparently considering the question. At last he said,
I've never liked that phrase. I've never really thought that it makes much sense, because it's describing something that doesn't exist.
What is a Jedi, young Padawan? Ahsoka eyed him.
A Force user in the Jedi Order who follows the code, she said finally. Someone who protects the weak, serves the Republic, the guardians of peace and justice in the galaxy.
Kenobi nodded, as though he had expected that answer.
And what is a dark Jedi?
The opposite of that, Ahsoka said, with the distinct feeling that she was walking into a trap. A Force user who doesn't follow the code. Someone who uses the dark side of the Force.
Is a dark Jedi still a Jedi? Kenobi asked.
No, Ahsoka said immediately. Of course not.
What about the Baron Doe? The Night Sisters of Dathomir, the Bardotans, the Koronai,
the Sith.
They're all Force users, but none of them follow the Jedi Code. Some of them use the dark side, some of them don't, and some of them don't even believe in it. Do you consider them dark Jedi?
No.
So what makes a dark Jedi, then? He asked,
sounding so calm that he could have been sitting in a classroom in the Jedi Temple instead of in a secure holding cell in the middle of a fleet of Republic warships.
Jedi who's turned to the dark side, Ahsoka said, starting to doubt herself.
Or a former Jedi, she added, hoping to see him flinch, but Kenobi just nodded.
So a dark Jedi is a Jedi who has turned to the dark side of the Force, he said. What if he still follows the Jedi Code and serves the Republic? If he uses the dark side to protect the weak and innocent, in order to preserve peace and justice in the galaxy?
You can't, Ahsoka said, floundering. You can't be a Jedi and use the dark side. It corrupts people. You can't use it and do any of that. People who use the dark side only do it for their own gain, so you...
I don't use the dark side, actually, Kenobi said, raising an eyebrow. Contrary to popular opinion.
I don't believe you. He sighed.
No one does. It's the truth, though.
He pushed a hand back through his hair.
All right, Padawan Tano. Tell me what a dark Jedi is.
Ahsoka frowned at him, thinking, and said carefully, A dark Jedi is a former Jedi who has ceased to follow the Jedi Code and uses all aspects of the Force, including the dark side, for his own benefit, thus forfeiting his right to be considered a member of the Jedi Order and all privileges of that rank.
But not to be called a Jedi, I see, Kenobi said,
his lips curving up in a brief smile.
Have you ever considered why that is, young Padawan?
No, Ahsoka admitted.
Do you know what I'm called by the Holonet?
She thought about it, then said reluctantly. The Queen's Knight, if they're being polite. Rogue Jedi, if they're not. Or renegade.
Even though I haven't been a Jedi in 12 years, and I was never a knight, I resigned before I could take my trials, Kenobi said. In the Republic, and in most of the known galaxy, Jedi is a byword for a Force user, good or bad. The Jedi themselves fall prey to this belief. Why else use the contradictory term Dark Jedi?
I've never thought about that, Ahsoka said.
Most people haven't, Kenobi said.
He rested his hands in his lap.
Do you still think I'm a Dark Jedi?
Ahsoka started to answer, then hesitated.
You're in rebellion against the Republic!
Which wasn't an answer to his question, but was as close as she wanted to get. He sighed.
No, we're in a war with the Republic. The Confederacy is a sovereign body. The Republic acknowledged our existence when they declared a state of war a week ago. Ask Master Plo if you don't believe me. I am not, and have never been, a traitor, either to the Republic or to the Jedi. You'd be wise to remember that, young Padawan.
Stop calling me that! Ahsoka snapped,
irritated and immediately ashamed of herself for being so.
Kenobi's eyebrows arched, but all he said was, My apologies, Padawan Tano. I didn't mean to be condescending.
That isn't... Apology accepted, Master... Captain Kenobi. Before he could comment on her slip, she added quickly, My master says that you didn't really kill Master Unduli and Master Koth. This time, she felt his faint amusement resonate in the Force, but he pretended to ignore the abrupt change in subject, and said graciously, I'm glad to hear that Master Plo believes me. I was under the impression that that wasn't a popular opinion.
Ahsoka scuffed at the Durasteel floor with the toe of one boot, looking down. She wasn't sure if she believed him herself, but it was hard to fool Plo Koon, and he seemed pretty sure.
Would you have killed him?
Kenobi was quiet for a long minute, thinking the question over.
In combat? Or self-defense, or defense of others?
Yes, he said at last.
Only if there was no other choice. Have you seen the holocam footage from the attack of Verdakino?
Ask Master Plo for it. I know the droid can manage to get a transmission out before I destroyed it.
Luminara and Master Koth attacked my queen in her home on a sovereign planet. I could have killed them then. I would have been within my rights, even by Republic standards. Which, by the way, I don't think highly of.
I couldn't tell, Ahsoka said dryly.
He smiled at her, but it fell away quickly.
I have done a lot of questionable things since I left the Order, but I haven't killed a Jedi in cold blood yet, and I wouldn't do it even if my queen ordered me to. Which she wouldn't.
I... Ahsoka began. Then the door to the secure cell swung open, and Mace Windu came in. Ahsoka straightened up from her slouch automatically, but Windu didn't seem to see her as he stalked over to stand in front of the ray shield.
Where are the files, Obi-Wan?
He demanded.
I don't know what you're talking about,
Kenobi said, tilting his head back to look at Windu.
The files Bail Organa took from the Special Operations Bureau. He doesn't have them. The Trade Federation doesn't have them. Where are they?
You searched me to the skin, Master Windu. What makes you think I have them?
Don't play games with me, Windu said, leaning forward. Where are the files?
Kenobi smirked.
Somewhere you haven't looked yet, he said.
The little astromech unit didn't look any worse for his sojourn in space. He warbled a greeting to Queen Amidala as he rolled forward, then opened a panel on his chassis and extended a thin arm towards her. The Queen took the data chip he was clutching, turning it over in her hands and looking at it.
Thank you, R2, she said quietly. Did you see him before the Jedi released you?
He made a distraught sound in the negative. Her voice was soft,
Show me the footage.
It was hard to watch, even though Padme had seen worse during the Holonet coverage of the war. She still flinched when Bail Organa was shot, biting a nail almost to the quick when Obi-Wan Kenobi went down after a pair of blows to the face from the commando droid. The Queen cried out, the sound small and broken in the room, but didn't look away until the hologram had ended, when Sabe put an arm around her shoulders and let Amidala press her face against her skirts, weeping.
It's over. It's done. He survived,
she murmured, curving one hand over the back of Amidala's neck as the Queen shook from the force of her sobs.
They didn't kill him.
They were in the Queen's solar again, alone except for Amidala's 5 handmaidens. Padme wasn't sure why she was here, especially since she couldn't help feeling as though she was intruding on something incredibly private. She didn't think that Amidala had simply forgotten that she was here. She wouldn't have, in the unlikely case that their positions had been reversed. Eventually, Amidala straightened up again, her eyes red beneath her smeared face paint. She passed the data chip she was still clutching to Irte, her voice wavering slightly as she said, "Get this to Glasswater House. Pick your people and put together a team to take it apart. If Lieutenant Commander Odessa protests, tell her to take it up with me. Only people you trust absolutely. We've already paid a high price to get these files, and I don't want any of it getting out. The Republic must know we have it by now, and the Special Operations Bureau will act quickly to make sure that the information on this chip is outdated as soon as possible." Irte accepted the data chip, her expression solemn. "Yes, my lady," she said, then curtsied quickly to the Queen and left the solar. "Contact Fleet Command and tell them to get a search and rescue ship with a starfighter escort out to Boz Pity immediately," Amidala went on, looking at Dorme, who immediately pulled her comlink out and stepped aside to do so. "I doubt there are any survivors, especially since the Jedi have been there already, but we have to be sure. Alderaan will want the remains returned if possible. Find out the time conversion to Alderaan so I can contact Queen Brea." "Yes, Your Majesty," Dorme said. Then, into her comlink. "This is the Crown. Put me through to the OOD. Amidala passed a hand over her face, smearing her paint further. "Is there anything else?" she asked R2. "Can you tell if his tracker is still functioning?" The astromech warbled a response, then rolled over to the comm panel and plugged in. A star chart formed in the center of the room, displaying first the known galaxy, then eventually narrowing in on a sector and a single star system. "That's not far from here," Rabe said, walking over to inspect it. Stars swirled around her midsection. She was standing in the center of the hologram. She glanced over at R2 as he beeped rapidly, then she shook her head. "But he probably isn't there anymore. This is almost 2 days old." "His tracker should be strong enough to signal through hyperspace, but there might be interference from other ships nearby," Amidala said dully. "And if what he told me about the Jedi holding cells is true, then it's probably blocking the signals unless they found it and removed it. That must be the system where they moved him from the Federation ship to a Republic warship." Rabe pulled out the star chart to a fuller view of the galaxy, splotches of color showing the areas of space controlled by various powers. Padme recognized the Confederacy and the Republic, and after a moment's hesitation, neutral space and hut space. But the fifth color was a mystery to her. Amidala sat up, her eyes narrowing. "The Republic won't risk taking those warships back through Confederate or Alliance space, and Satine forced the Senate to forbid taking military convoys through neutral space last year. The Hutts won't be happy, but Windu might risk it if he can get his ships in and out quickly enough." "All they're doing is flashing in and out of real space between hyperlanes," Rabe pointed out. "For that many ships? 30 minutes at minimum, maybe 6 hours at maximum, since our sensors indicate that a lot of the Federation ships sustained damage to their hyperdrive generators, which will slow them down. Depending on the system, most of the huts don't have the firepower to do more than lodge a strongly worded complaint with the Senate. As if, Sabe snorted. R2, work up the most likely routes that fleet is taking back to Coruscant, Amidala said. She glanced around at her handmaidens. Are we agreed that Coruscant is the most likely destination? Dooku will want Obi-Wan and the others under his eye, and our intelligence indicates that most of the Republic High Command is still on Coruscant, including leading members of the Jedi High Council. The other handmaidens nodded. The Republic is more centralized than the Confederacy, Maltier said. Chancellor Dooku won't keep those Federation officers in command of their ships, so they'll have to return to Coruscant to be replaced by Republic naval officers. My thoughts exactly, Amidala said. She glanced at Padme. Will your Jedi answer a question for me? Padme hesitated. They don't know anything about the Republic military here. Not about the Republic military. About the Jedi. I don't know, Padme said. Maybe. Probably. Get them in here, Amidala ordered. Yes, Your Highness. Motier left immediately, the door sliding open and shutting again behind her. R2 was still running out the route calculations. Amidala sat back in her armchair, accepting a cloth from Dorme to clean her smeared paint off her face, until only the stain of her beauty marks and the scar of remembrance remained. Padme remembered vividly how hard those were to get off without remover. What is the Alliance? Padme asked. The Alliance of Sovereign Systems, Sabe said. But Amidala didn't reply, her expression distracted. Other separatist systems that seceded after Naboo. A few were independent before, but most were Republic until recently. They have a philosophical disagreement with the Confederacy. They don't want another centralized government, Maltier said. Individual systems held together by agreements of mutual aid against outside aggression. She shook her head, her expression disapproving. Chaos and anarchy. Actually giving them a name is just a catch-all for convenience. They're nowhere near organized enough to deserve it. Amidala glanced up, wiping a smudge of white paint from her chin. The Dorme took the cloth from her hand and took over to get the spots she had missed. The Alliance doesn't exist in your universe? Padme shook her head. Aside from the huts, you're either Republic or Separatist. Even the neutral systems are technically still part of the Republic, even if the Senate won't offer them any support as long as they refuse to back the war. She glanced down, studying the pattern of the carpet. Most of them have recanted since what happened last year. The Duchess Satine was killed when Mandalore was taken over by the Death Watch, and the Council of Neutral Systems crumbled after that came out. Amidala started. Satine's dead? How? Padme hesitated. What had happened on Mandalore was so classified that no one outside of the Jedi High Council was supposed to know about it. But Obi-Wan had told her during that chaotic week after Odrin. But it didn't matter now. Darth Maul murdered her in order to hurt Obi-Wan. The queen's eyes widened, and there was a murmur of disquiet from the handmaidens before Amidala spat. Darth Maul is dead! Are you sure? Amidala swallowed. Yes, I saw the body. We burned it. Not a real funeral. Obi-Wan wouldn't give him that honor. Padme wondered what had changed in this universe. If they had been able to shut down the plasma refinery just a little bit sooner, or if it hadn't been active at all during Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon's duel with Maul, or if the duel itself had gone differently. Obi-Wan never talked about it. But she had seen the security cam footage afterwards.
We never recovered a body, she told Amidala, and saw the other woman breathe out in what was probably relief. We assumed he had been destroyed, but somehow he used the Force to sustain himself and escape. The Jedi don't know where he was for the next 12 years. He just turned up suddenly with one of... with a dark Jedi, who turned out to be his brother. And they started killing people in order to get the Order's attention. To get Obi-Wan's attention. Amidala's hands clenched into fists. Is he dead now? We don't know, Padme told her. It doesn't matter here, I suppose. As long as you're sure he's dead. We're sure, Amidala said. Then was distracted by Moltier's return with Anakin and Obi-Wan. Master Jedi, she said. Thank you for joining us. Anakin and Obi-Wan bowed. Anakin's gaze immediately went to R2-D2, who was still plugged into the wall and humming absently to himself.
R2? He said.
The astromech swiveled its dome around to peer at Anakin, made a noise of acknowledgement, then saw Obi-Wan and let out an astonished and confused series of beeps.
I'm really starting to feel underappreciated here, Anakin muttered.
Amidala looked between them, her eyebrows raised, but all she said was, Of your courtesy, Master Jedi, I have a question that I would appreciate your input on. You aren't obliged to answer.
Obi-Wan looked concerned. Anakin and I aren't familiar with the Republic military in this universe, he said.
I have analysts for that, Amidala said. I'd like a Jedi's opinion on something else.
No, Anakin said,
garnering a surprised look from Obi-Wan. He flushed a little, but crossed his arms over his chest and blundered on anyway.
Fighting the Federation is one thing. Doing favors for a Jedi killer and a Separatist are something else.
Moltier slapped him.
Ow!
Anakin slapped a hand to his cheek, staring at her.
What was that for?
Her Royal Highness isn't a Jedi killer, Moltier snapped. You idiot child.
What did you just call me?
Anakin said, outraged.
I'm a Jedi Knight!
Anakin, Obi-Wan stepped forward to lay a hand on his arm. Anakin shook him off.
No, Obi-Wan, I want an answer! Luminara Unduli and Eeth Koth are dead because of her! Why should we help her or her Darksider traitor lover?
Moltier stepped forward again, her hand raised before Rabe grabbed her wrist. Anakin took a hasty step away from her, almost backing into Obi-Wan. Queen Amidala hadn't moved from her seat, though she had flinched at the mention of Captain Kenobi.
It's a fair question, she allowed.
Moltier and several of the other handmaidens turned astonished looks on her. Sabe put a hand on the back of the Queen's chair and glared warningly at them. Padme shifted her position slightly, closer to Anakin and Obi-Wan, because she wanted to hear this too. Amidala studied Anakin's furious expression for a few seconds, then said, Master Unduli and Master Koth aren't dead. They're being held on Naboo while I decide what to do with them, but they aren't dead. Someone in this palace betrayed me, and sent out a transmission with a digital generation of a public execution, and a speech that I assure you I would never have been so foolish as to make in public. Padme noted that she didn't say at all. Anakin's jaw tightened.
Prove it, he snapped.
They're in the palace, aren't they?
Obi-Wan said, before Amidala had a chance to answer.
I thought I sensed a familiar presence here.
Amidala hesitated for a second.
Yes, they're here, she said at last.
We want to see them, Anakin insisted. Obi-Wan glanced at him, but didn't argue, just looked at the Queen.
That could be arranged, Amidala said, though she didn't sound happy about it.
But if you ever call my husband a Darksider again, Jedi, I'll have your tongue ripped from your head.
Anakin actually flinched back at the viciousness of her tone, then seemed to register the threat itself and stared at her in surprise. Padme looked at the Queen, a little chilled to realize that Amidala was completely serious. Some of her handmaidens looked ready to get the tongs out then and there. From Motier's expression, she was still considering the virtue of slapping the insolence out of Anakin, Jedi Knight or not. Into the silence that followed this pronouncement, R2 let out a soft warble. As though eager to stave off any further conflict, the star chart still hanging in the center of the room flickered, then updated with colored lines tracing various hyperlanes from Naboo to Coruscant.
What are we looking at, Your Highness? Obi-Wan asked politely. If he was embarrassed by Anakin's outburst, he was too professional, and practiced at dealing with them, to show it.
Probable routes that the Republic fleet will be taking back to Coruscant, based on the last known transmission from Obi-Wan's subcutaneous tracker, Amidala said stiffly.
We're assuming that either further transmissions are being blocked by the shielding on a consular-class cruiser, or that it's been removed.
That's standard practice, Obi-Wan allowed, his voice cautious. Scanners on consular cruisers will pick up unauthorized transmissions, even the low-level subspace kind subcutaneous trackers put out.
Amidala nodded, unsurprised.
What I wanted to ask, Master Jedi, was whether or not the Jedi Council would make a prisoner exchange.
Obi-Wan hesitated, thinking.
The situation has actually never come up, he said at last. Our separatists, don't negotiate. Not for planets, not for ships, and certainly not for individuals, no matter how valuable.
That isn't... Anakin began, then winced. He went on, very reluctantly.
That isn't quite true?
Obi-Wan looked at him in surprise, but Padme nodded, realizing what Anakin was talking about.
That wasn't the Jedi Council, though, she said. It was Queen Mutiny, the current Queen of Naboo, and Boss Lyony. But Count Dooku was the one who made the offer.
So Dooku might be reasonable, Amidala said, sounding cautiously relieved.
But the Council...
Obi-Wan was still frowning at Anakin, but he turned his attention back to the Queen to say,
The High Council will never negotiate. Not even for the release of two knights. They'll send in a strike team once there's certain Luminara and Aeth are still alive.
I agree, Anakin said after a moment. If it was just one master... But the Council won't negotiate. The Order doesn't believe in compromising.
Amidala shut her eyes for an instant.
I see, she said. Then I'll continue to hope that it's the Supreme Chancellor I'm negotiating with, not the Jedi Order.
Anakin glanced at Obi-Wan, but Obi-Wan was studying the star map. Abruptly, he said,
Mace will probably take one of these two routes, pointing them out in the hologram. In his place, I would backtrack into the Outer Rim to throw off pursuit, loop through the Tatooine system, and go this way. But Mace will most likely go through Dinan or Kashyyyk.
I concur, Anakin said reluctantly. I'd take this route through Christophsis, but you can guarantee that whatever I do, Master Windu will do the opposite. Either way, they'll have to come out of hyperspace in the Gaius system to divert hyperlanes, Rabe said, frowning at the hologram. There aren't any habitable planets there, but there's a Republic trade station because it's Hyperpoint. Your Highness, the First Fleet is en route to Both Y. If they divert now, they can intercept the Republic fleet at Gaius. They've got enough firepower to take on whatever defensive elements there are in the system.
The Bothans won't be happy about that, Amidala noted.
No, but the Federation fleet that attacked us was supposed to join the Republic siege. That could give the Bothans a chance to break through the blockade.
Or Pantora could stop complaining and actually use their warships for a change, Sabe said dryly. They're close enough to Both Y to affect the siege.
That would be a first, Amidala said dryly. She glanced at Dorme. Get me fleet command.
Yes, my lady.
Amidala took a deep breath and looked back at Obi-Wan and Anakin.
Thank you for your advice, Master Jedi, she said. I appreciate it.
Obi-Wan bowed to her, with Anakin following suit a beat afterwards.
I hope you get your husband back, Your Majesty, he said, sounding a little hesitant.
His gaze flicked to Padme. She glanced aside before she could see if it lingered or not.
Thank you. Amidala folded her hands in her lap.
It strikes me that I haven't yet thanked you for your actions yesterday, Master Jedi. That was my error. On behalf of the people of Naboo, I thank you both.
It was our pleasure, Your Majesty, Obi-Wan said,
then looked meaningfully at Anakin. Anakin glanced aside, as though having some sort of debate within himself, then eventually met the Queen's curious gaze and said,
We're Jedi, Your Majesty. Our duty is to protect the innocent against all enemies.
It was a little stiff, with none of Obi-Wan's studied grace, but Padme could tell how much it cost him to say. The Queen inclined her head slightly in acknowledgement.
I have never found fault with the Jedi when they follow the mandate of the Jedi Code, she said.
Anakin frowned, but didn't respond. Padme said politely,
Excuse me, Your Majesty, but what do you mean to do with us?
Amidala's gaze went to her.
Nothing, she said. As you've seen, I have bigger things to worry about than two Jedi, a clone, and a Republic senator, none of whom officially exist. You are welcome to stay or leave as you like, though I warn you that you won't find much welcome in the Republic if you seek to try Coruscant next. The comm panel by the door chimed. Dorme answered it, her expression going horrified in response to whatever she heard.
What is it? The Queen snapped.
That was Fleet Command, Dorme said. The Second Fleet has lost contact with Strike Group 5. The last transmission from the Battlestar Intrepid was from Commodore Nanda, stating that Strike Group 5 was going to get revenge for the Republic attack on Naboo and exhorting all ships in the Second Fleet to join them.
Amidala went white. What does Strike Group 5 consist of? Dorme consulted her datapad.
One Battlestar, Intrepid, the 3rd Battlecruiser Division, the 12th Heavy Cruiser Division, the 4th and 7th Destroyer Squadrons, and the 9th, 10th, and 13th Light Cruiser Squadrons. 40 ships, with almost 100 starfighters and bombers between them. The 8th Heavy Cruiser Division left the 2nd Fleet and joined them, along with half a dozen individual ships, while several ships from the 7th Destroyer Squadron and the 12th Heavy Cruiser Division remained behind.
Not all of those are Naboo ships, Rabe said, startled.
Admiral Hamilcar informed Fleet Command that the 2nd Fleet received an unauthorized transmission informing them of the attack on Naboo about an hour before Strike Group 5 broke away, Dorme said, her voice professionally even, despite the distress on her face. The 2nd Fleet's current location would put Strike Group 5 within 6 hours of hyperspace transit of Sereno. That was 4 hours ago. Everyone's gaze shot towards the star chart.
Hell, Amidala breathed. Reprisal.
I should have seen it coming. There's certainly been enough talk about it here on Naboo. If we start attacking Republic worlds, then we'll never avoid a drawn-out war. She stood up abruptly. I want a conference with Fleet Command, Planetary Defense, and all available Flag and General officers in half an hour. Until then, tell Fleet Command to keep trying to punch through to Strike Group 5. If they do, put me through immediately. Celador will listen to me. Yes, my lady, Dorme said, turning back to the comm panel. This is the Crown, she began. Amidala glanced at Anakin and Obi-Wan. Excuse me, she said. I'm needed elsewhere. Of course, Your Majesty, Obi-Wan said. If there's anything, there isn't. Her gaze flickered to Padme. Then she nodded once, the movement so slight that Padme would have overlooked it if she hadn't been waiting for it. Rabi, please escort the Jedi back to their chambers. I'll be in the throne room.